You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest says President Trump's proposed cuts to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative would hurt the economies of states that helped Trump win the election.
First, after Donald Trump was elected, the United States saw a surge of activism among women. The 2017 Women's March after President Trump's inauguration was the largest single-day march in U.S. history.
But that growth of activism and political engagement among women may not have much of an impact on who ends up on the ballot. A new report finds that there has not been an increase in women running for office.
Jennifer Lawless is one of the authors of the report. She joins us now. She's a professor of government and director of the Women and Politics Institute at American University. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You called this report the Trump effect. What was the idea behind the Trump effect when it came to women running for office?
Well, there was widespread speculation when we saw increased levels of political engagement and activism that the upside for Democrats of Donald Trump getting elected is that we'd see a surge in the number of female candidates. What we call the Trump effect is, in fact, that increased activism, but no commensurate surge in political ambition. Most of the women who have been energized are still not at all interested in throwing their own hats into the ring.
We've heard just anecdotally a couple training programs for women Democratic candidates here and there. They say they've seen higher enrollment. How did you, though, try to put this to a more rigorous test?
Well, what we did was we did a national survey of people that we would consider potential candidates. So roughly 2,100 women and men who are employed full-time and who have college degrees, since that's what the majority of state legislative and congressional candidates look like. And we asked them about their levels of political engagement, their levels of political participation, and also if they've ever considered running for office or if they would consider running for office in the future. And what we found was that among women, the levels of interest in running for office when compared to men looked a lot like they had over the course of the last 15 or 16 years. So overall, there was still about a 15 percentage point gap in political ambition, even though the women that we surveyed were more politically engaged and more politically active than the men.
Is it typical that we see women who are politically engaged seek venues other than running for office? Are they heavily engaged just not in that one particular get on the ballot kind of way?
Yes. So generally speaking, when we go back to surveys, even as early as 2001 from potential candidates, we find that women are about as politically active as men, but that activism drops off when it gets to running for office. They tend to think that there are more effective ways to bring about positive change than putting their own names on the ballot. The reason that we expected there to be a surge this time around was because we saw unprecedented levels of activism among women, so much so that they far trumped, no pun intended, activism among men.
And what did women say about what they were thinking about politics in this Donald Trump era? Did it look different than it had before?
On the Democratic side, it definitely did. So we asked a series of questions about people's attitudes toward Donald Trump, his victory, but also there were Republicans in the sample, and we asked them about their attitudes toward Hillary Clinton. And what we found generally were that Democrats had very, very high negatives for Trump, which is not at all surprising. But women were even more likely than men to say that they were turned off, that they were appalled, that they were depressed by the victory. And the negative attitudes toward Trump on the part of Democrats were far, far greater than Republicans' negative attitudes toward Clinton. So this wasn't just a partisan story. There's something about Trump that is causing people to have, especially women, a pretty visceral reaction. That visceral reaction is what's allowing them to show up for these marches, send checks to candidates, join political interest groups, but it doesn't seem to be enough to really spur interest in running for office.
Talking to Jennifer Lawless now from the Women in Politics Institute at American University, looking at the Trump effect, or lack of same, it turns out, when it comes to motivating women to run for office. So Jennifer, as you mentioned, the numbers you saw are consistent with what we've seen in the past. Women less likely to run for office than men. Why?
Well, there are two big reasons that we found traditionally. The first is that women are less likely than men to be recruited to run, so they're less likely to get that suggestion in the first place. The second is that they're less likely to think they're qualified, often because they think that there's widespread bias and discrimination against female candidates, so they'd have to be twice as good to get half as far. Now, that perception of bias and discrimination is the good news, not actually empirical reality. So when women run for office, they're just as likely as men to win. They raise just as much money. And at least at the congressional level and downward, they're treated pretty similarly by the media. The recruitment piece is a problem, but this is the one piece of good news that does come out of Donald Trump's presidency. On the Democratic side of the aisle, that recruitment gap has closed pretty substantially, where Democratic men and women are roughly equally likely to say that a party leader, an elected official, or a political activist has encouraged them to run. That's not true on the Republican side. So part of the reason that the gender gap in political ambition is at least a little bit smaller among Democrats than Republicans right now is likely because these organizations that are recruiting candidates are targeting women more so than ever before.
To the extent we can be this precise, I mean, if we compare a woman and a man, each of them with the same level of education, background, political motivation, even with all those things being equal, the man, if I'm hearing this right, is still more likely to run for office.
That's right, about a third more likely. Now, again, the overwhelming majority of people never run for office and aren't interested in doing so. But among that group of people who are somewhat strange in that they are willing to put their names on the ballot, women are about a third less likely than men to fall into that category, especially now on the Republican side of the aisle where there's been no bump whatsoever. The Democratic bump is certainly not at all what it looks like compared to levels of activism, but the gender gap in political ambition is at least a little bit smaller on the Democratic side.
Have you studied this kind of backwards, taking women who have run for office successfully or not and kind of worked backwards to see maybe what made them different than the population at large?
Well, we know among the people who have said that they've run in the samples of potential candidates that we've been studying since 2001, that the two biggest predictors of actually throwing your hat into the ring are thinking that you're qualified and having other people encourage you to do so. And it's not just party leaders and elected officials. When people have encouragement from their family members, colleagues, and friends, that makes the idea of running for office also more desirable. So when we look at the people who have run, almost all of them, women and men alike, believe that they're highly qualified and believe that they are responding to this encouragement to throw their hats into the ring. The other difference that we tend to see in studies is that women are more likely to say that they ran because they were motivated by a policy, and men are more likely to say that they ran because they wanted power or prestige. The thing that's tricky about those kinds of measures is that it might still be the case that in our society today, it would be unacceptable for a woman to say, oh, I ran for office because I want power. And so it's possible that those kinds of responses reflect some traditional attitudes about what's appropriate for women and men.
What do we gain, regardless of our partisan perspective, what do we gain if we have more women running for office and, in theory, serving in office?
Well, I'd say three things. The first is a sense of democratic legitimacy. Something seems fundamentally wrong with a political system where our citizenry is more than half female, yet overall our elected officials are 80% men. We have no problem talking to other nations and encouraging them to make sure that they have at least 25 or 30 or 35% women in their legislatures, and that's just a standard to which we've never held ourselves. The second factor that I think is an important consequence is that it sends a clear message to the next generation that politics is open and inclusive. You can't be what you don't see, and so if young women and girls don't see women holding positions of political power, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And third, even though party is the biggest predictor of how a legislator will vote or what policies a candidate will support, within each party, women are still more likely than men to prioritize issues that have to do with women, families, and children. So they're not more likely to be bipartisan or cross party lines, but within their parties, they're more likely to represent women's interests within each of those parties.
Before we wrap up, Jennifer, is there any sign that having women run for high profile national office, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, you know, on that big high profile race, does that sway women's participation in getting on the ballot one way or another?
Well, I think that probably what happens is that it's a wash. For some women, it motivates them because they see these women and they're inspired by them. But by the same token, when you look at presidential politics, you also see the worst and most awful aspects of campaigns. This time around, we saw men behaving badly, and a lot of women will step back and think, oh my gosh, if that's how they're treating women in politics, I would never do that. People look at politics through a national lens and assume that that kind of behavior trickles down when in fact it doesn't. So a lot of the time, studies reveal that there doesn't seem to be a broad role model effect in terms of getting more women on the ballot, because I think these two competing dynamics are working hand in hand.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Jennifer Lawless, professor of government and director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. She joined us to talk about women's interest in running for public office.
In his budget proposal, President Trump is calling for a drastic cut to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. The cut, if approved, would take funding from $300 million down to $10 million. Over the last several years, the initiative has enjoyed strong bipartisan support in an era of polarized politics.
Our next guest says that the president's proposed cut would not only hurt the health of the Great Lakes and the economies of the Great Lakes states, it could put Trump in an unpopular position in states that brought him big wins in the 2016 election.
Peter Annan joins us now. He's the author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, and he co-directs the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you.
What kind of reaction has the proposed cut from President Trump gotten from people involved in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative?
Yeah, there's been really a kind of a remarkable bipartisan negative reaction on Capitol Hill. You know, this is a really always been a really strong bipartisan program, and congressmen and women in the president's party have they're sort of tiptoeing around a direct confrontation with the president over it. But there's clearly some concern. And originally, the word was going to be that the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative would be cut from $300 million to $10 million. But the actual skinny budget, so-called skinny budget, that the president released actually zeroed out the program completely. And so there's a lot of concern on Capitol Hill, again, throughout most of the Great Lakes congressional delegation on both sides of the aisle about that proposed cut. And it'll be interesting to see what happens over coming months as the Hill pulls together some kind of budget for the fiscal year.
I want to mention a quote from Scott Pruitt, new head of the EPA, and he recently had this to say. He was meeting with some representatives from Ohio. He said, "I believe we can fulfill the mission of our agency with a trim budget." Went on to say, "We are committed to working with all states in the region to ensure water quality standards are advanced and protected," not specific to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. But do you think that the agency can keep up with water projects and other water priorities if this zeroing of the budget goes through?
Yeah, and so that was a hearing last week, subcommittee hearing on last week under questioning from Congressman David Joyce, Republican of Ohio. It was very pointed questions of Administrator Pruitt, and there were some delicate answers going on there, and I think, you know, so the direct answer to your question is, if things continue as proposed by the president, no, I don't think it's possible to continue things business as usual. But what I'm hearing is that a lot of the people behind the scenes on Capitol Hill are believing that they'd be very surprised if the GLRI was not continued at some level. They're talking between, say, $200 million and $300 million. So they'd be really surprised if there was the normal, usual $300 million allocation that we've had for the last several years. And they'd also be surprised, however, if it got below $200 million. So there's kind of a surprising amount of what I would call quiet, cautious optimism on the Hill that some kind of funding will emerge. Nevertheless, there remains a lot of concern about the proposed lack of any funding for this highly popular bipartisan program.
What is it about this particular initiative for the Great Lakes that brought people together across political and ideological divides?
Yeah, and you know, that's really an interesting question. I think there's been a lot of research, first of all, on the need. And, you know, the Great Lakes were this incredible water-based juggernaut that fueled the economy during the last century. But what we saw is that there was extensive lack of sustainable economic development in the last century, weak water laws, and that really was the demise of Lake Erie that brought about, very influential, bringing about the Clean Water Act. Since then, there's been an acknowledgement that actually restoration is not just good for the Great Lakes environment, it's also good for the Great Lakes economy. The Brookings Institution did a highly influential study looking at Great Lakes restoration and found that for every dollar invested, $2 in economic development resulted. And so this is not just an environmental policy or program in the Great Lakes region. It's also an economic program in the Great Lakes region. And so, you know, getting that 100% return on every dollar invested is a pretty good rate for the federal government.
Can you talk about that connection a little more? Why would Great Lakes restoration help power the economy of these states that surround them?
Yeah, so part of it is, you know, the dollars invested, they're often partnered with state dollars, in some cases public-private partnerships. And so there's a sort of a direct investment there. Secondly, if you look at the fact that once waterways that were once polluted, brownfields once polluted, are cleaned up, then you see condos moving in, you see coffee shops and restaurants moving in around the condos, and so it creates this redevelopment of the Great Lakes waterfront. I mean, what we saw during the last century, heavily industrialized waterfronts, people kind of turned their backs on the Great Lakes because it was sort of filthy and polluted and stunk. Now that this sort of there's this change in the Great Lakes waterfronts through restorations, people are re-embracing the Great Lakes like never before in some of these waterfront areas, and that's refueling economic development, bringing people closer to the environment of the Great Lakes, and again, and great economic benefit as well.
We're talking with Peter Annan right now from Northland College, talking about President Trump's proposal to zero out the budget for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and the impact that could have, and what might happen next in that budget. And Northland College, Peter, recently held a water summit, and there was a paper written afterwards about its findings, looking at the successes and the future priorities for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. What's still at the top of the to-do list?
Yeah, well, the water summit was held before the presidential election, which is really kind of interesting because I think, you know, we had about two dozen experts in the room from bipartisan groups and states, and representing, you know, Republican governors, Republican congressionals, as well as Democrat groups. And, you know, I think the feeling in the room, as there was sort of throughout the nation based on polling and everything, is that, you know, that the person who was going to be elected president was going to be Hillary Clinton. And yet this was a nonpartisan exercise, and the white paper was sent to both presidential campaigns. And so what's been really interesting is that I don't think anybody in the room thought that the program would necessarily be proposed to be zeroed out. And so what's interesting is that the first, the number one point on the white paper was that the program should continue because, A, the work still remains to be done. Economically, it makes perfect sense because of the return on the investment for the federal government, and it's highly popular bipartisan program. What's interesting historically about GLRI is that President Obama would regularly propose $250 million for GLRI, and the Republican-led Congress would increase that to $300 million in the ultimate budget that came through. That happened several times in recent years. And the most popular, the most heavily funded part of GLRI is to restore what are known as areas of concern. You can think of them like Superfund sites on the shores of the Great Lakes. And that's where the vast majority, or I shouldn't say the vast majority, but the largest single chunk of restoration dollars have gone. And several of these areas of concern have made great headway after decades of kind of being stagnant. Restoration sites have made great headway in recent years. Some of them been completely delisted and reclaimed. And so there's progress that's been made there. And so there is specific interest in continuing GLRI support of the Areas of Concern program restoration. But then there's also been habitat restoration and invasive species restoration. A lot of the Asian carp dollars to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes come from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So there's a lot, again, the feeling in the room for the water summit that we hosted, again, which was a nonpartisan water summit, was that the program needs to continue work remains to be done, and it's a highly popular bipartisan program.
And Peter, as we just start to wrap up here, you said earlier that there is a kind of quiet optimism on the Hill that this zeroing out of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative will not, in fact, be what goes through, that there will be some money there in possibly the two to three hundreds of millions as it has been. But if for some reason this cut, the zeroing out, did go through as planned, what would the potential impact be?
Well, I think we're just going to see some of these areas that seemed like they had a chance of being restored to the way they were before they were heavily damaged through industrialization or sewage pollution or runoff, they're going to continue to be problems. I mean, don't forget, 2014, city of Toledo, 400,000 people on Lake Erie didn't have drinking water because of pollution from polluted runoff and algal blooms. I mean, that's where we would continue, presumably, to see problems like that. God forbid that Asian carp would actually end up entering the Great Lakes into sustainable reproducing populations. I mean, you know, there are a lot of potential issues that people will literally be able to see, feel, witness, and experience if the trajectory is changed here. And that's what people are concerned about in the Great Lakes region, again, both sides of the aisle.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Peter Annan is the author of the book, The Great Lakes Water Wars, and he co-directs the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College in Ashland. And he joined us to talk about President Trump's proposal to cut funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
Republicans in the Senate unveiled their own bill to roll back many parts of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. It's the latest move in Congress to dismantle one of President Obama's signature policies while he was in office.
Senate leadership aims to vote on the bill ahead of the July 4th recess, but the GOP Senate bill could hit a snag from within its own party, as some Republican senators have said that they don't think they'll be able to vote on the bill as it stands, including Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson.
Donna Friedsam joins us now. She's a researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. Donna, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, big picture, how different is this Senate bill from the House Republican health care plan passed a little while back?
Well, it makes some fairly significant changes from the House plan, but overall, I would say that it shares one thing in common, which is it doesn't dismantle completely the Obamacare structure. It retains for many years the tax subsidies for purchasing health insurance and the exchange structure that we know. And it also uses this method of passing a bill for repealing and replacing Obamacare to make substantial changes to the Medicaid program.
And Medicaid, let's talk about that. That seems to be getting a lot of the attention. What would change in Medicaid under the Senate plan?
The Senate plan has quite substantial changes to the Medicaid program, similar to the House bill, the AHCA. Both bills, the Senate bill today as well as the House bill, would change the longstanding Medicaid program from what it is today being an entitlement program, to either a per capita cap or a block grant to states, both of them being limiting federal contribution in the long term and transferring more federal funding responsibility to state governments.
I want to listen to President Trump talking about the new bill coming out at a news event earlier today. Here's a listen.
I think it's going to come out. Obamacare is a disaster. It's dead, totally dead. And we're putting in a plan today that's going to be negotiated. We'd love to have some Democrat support, but they're obstructionists. They'll never support. We won't get one, no matter how good it is. But we will hopefully get something done, and it'll be something with heart and very meaningful.
Let's talk about that first point, Obamacare, disaster, it's dead. And we've heard that another insurer is withdrawing coverage from some places, including some counties in Wisconsin. Today that news is out. Is this a case where we need to replace a program that's really falling apart?
So the news that Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield is withdrawing from Wisconsin counties is not a signal that the Affordable Care Act is dead in Wisconsin. The Blue Cross Blue Shield plans were a very small part of the Wisconsin market, and we still have 14 insurance carriers that are offering plans in Wisconsin through the Affordable Care Act. We haven't heard, in fact, we have had preliminary confirmation that those plans are planning on offering through the exchange in the coming year. So the program continues in a fairly robust way in Wisconsin, and we have about 230,000 people in our state who have selected plans in 2017 through and about 190,000 of them are receiving the premium tax credits. That's not to say there aren't problems with Obamacare, and in fact we hear about other states where there's very little insurance coverage or availability in certain counties. And the difference is that we have a very vibrant insurance market in our state with many insurance carriers, and other states are more reliant on these large national carriers who have been less interested in providing insurance products through the Obamacare marketplace. So it really varies depending on what state people are in, but there are a number of states where the Affordable Care Act is still functioning very well, and then in some states it's not doing well at all.
President Trump, as candidate Trump, had distinguished himself from his Republican primary opponents as the one candidate who wouldn't call for or allow Medicaid cuts. In this plan, in effect, are we seeing Medicaid cuts?
This plan has quite substantial Medicaid reductions. It looks like it's about a 25% reduction over 10 years, and so this is similar to the House bill that also had very substantial reductions in Medicaid funding. There would be a transfer of what is currently federal cost sharing that would change to state responsibility for funding the Medicaid program overall. And in general, an expectation that there would be a decline in enrollment in Medicaid over a number of years.
And some people have been pointing toward the year 2025 under the Senate plan. The way Medicaid increases are calculated, it would change. It wouldn't be connected to the consumer price index overall, or the medical consumer price index. It would go to the consumer price index.
Right.
It seems like a subtle point, but the effect, it sounds like, would be very substantial reductions in the amount that Medicaid goes up from year to year, that it wouldn't be able to keep up with rising medical costs. Is that right?
People expect that to be the case. Frankly, in either case, whether it is the consumer price index medical or whether it's just the straight CPI, it will be difficult for states to manage their Medicaid program costs under that rate of increase. But certainly changing it from the CPI medical to the straight CPI does present an additional challenge to states and will likely make them have to either reduce the program enrollment or benefit the amount of benefits covered or the payments to providers, or else in some way figure out how to find some kinds of efficiencies that today we're not aware of in order to save expenses under the program.
Donna Friedsam is with us, researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She's with us today for a look at the new Senate health care plan.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the new Senate bill? What do you think about Obamacare potentially going away? And do you think repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act is a good idea or a bad idea? Call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation now with Donna Friedsam from UW-Madison's Population Health Institute, looking at the details of the Senate Republican health care plan.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the Senate's new health care plan? What are your thoughts on this battle over the Affordable Care Act, and what would you like to see lawmakers accomplish with new health care laws? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And this isn't a done deal yet, of course. Donna, some GOP senators are saying they're not on board with this yet. I want to give a listen to Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. He is among a group of four senators who wrote a letter expressing concern. Here he is on CNN today.
What I've told leadership very clearly is I'm going to need time, and my constituents are going to need time to evaluate exactly how this is going to affect them. So I personally think that holding a vote on this next week would definitely be rushed. I can't imagine, quite honestly, that I'd have the information to evaluate and justify a yes vote within just a week.
So, Donna, still some negotiation likely to go on here. What kind of things do you think are going to be at play? What should we be watching for that might change?
Well, there's several things of concern, and they vary depending on the perspective of the senators, of course. The more conservative senators, and I would place Senator Johnson in that category, tend to be concerned about how much the bill is retaining of the current Obamacare structure and the kinds of tax subsidies that will continue into the future. But as well, a number of states have concerns about the Medicaid expansion. Of course, Wisconsin does not have a Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, but so Wisconsin's concern tends to be how it treats states that did not participate in the Medicaid expansion. But many of the senators that represent states that did expand Medicaid, and there are several Republican senators that do represent Medicaid expansion states, are quite concerned about what's going to happen to those Medicaid expansion states. But ultimately, all the senators are concerned about the significant decline in federal funding for Medicaid and how it's going to affect their states. I do think, though, particularly the four senators that came out today with their statement, in addition, have a concern about how much this is possibly retaining of the current tax subsidies going into the future, and the structure of the subsidies, and who it's going to benefit, and who it might not benefit as much.
Let's go to our callers now. Terry is on the line in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on. First of all, I think this entire bill needs to be thrown out, but we need to do what we can to support the ACA and the marketplaces and give people, individuals, the opportunity to buy health insurance. We need to continue to move in that direction. But at the same time, too, you played some comments from Senator Johnson there, who said he wants public input. He wants constituents to weigh in. I want to know what that is going to look like. Is it going to be town halls? Is this going to be debated across the state? Is this going to be debated across the country? This needs to be a debate, and needs to have public hearings, expert testimony, and a lot of talk around the conversation of healthcare across the nation.
Terry, thanks a lot for that call. And Don, I know you focus a lot on the policy side of things. Are you concerned about the process side of things as well? Possibly a rush to do some complicated legislation.
Well, I think a lot of people have noted that this has been a process that has not been as open as might have been, and this addresses us 1/6 of the U.S. economy. So it is a very serious policy, and people want to make sure that whatever happens is going to improve the lives of the population, and that we carefully consider the effects on various states and on various groups of people. So I think Terry makes a very valid point there, and Senator Johnson, as well as Senator Baldwin, and people all across the spectrum have said we need to discuss this, and this is difficult to be done, you know, when the bill was done behind closed doors and is being done in a very rushed manner. I think people have voiced some concerns around that. At the same time, others have recognized that this is such a highly politicized process that some people feel that the only way they could have even gotten a bill written and to the floor would have been through this kind of more secretive process. That being said, I believe that whatever happens over the next week, we're going to be seeing the CBO score, and just like we saw in the House, if there are not going to be enough votes, and they're going to need the 50 votes in order to pass this, then they won't they won't bring it to a vote by next week. So ultimately, it's going to be up to people to contact their senators to voice their concerns or whether they support the bill and want to see them vote yes, or if they're against the bill, or if they just would like the process to slow down. They are going to need to voice that to their Senate offices and let them know what they would like their senators to do.
Terry, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Joan in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Hi. My comment is that the Affordable Care Act was set up by President Obama out of compassion for people who needed health care. And it was just that, affordable, the Affordable Care Act. With all these cuts in this, what's called to be Trump Care, what have you, with all the cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, it's going to be an unaffordable care act. I'm seeing no compassion in any of these senators that are voting for this. I'm seeing no compassion in the people who really, well, for it, for instance, the insurance companies as well, because they want to just opt out. That's my comment, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
Joan, thanks for the call. Donna, do we have an idea? I know the CBO will still score this. Do we have an idea of how this Senate plan would affect affordability and overall coverage rates?
So, of course, the bill was just released this morning, so we don't have a lot of very strong empirical analyses. But what, from what we can see so far, it would suggest that there's not a lot that's going to affect the overall cost of health care, or really very little to nothing that's going to affect the overall cost of health care. It's very likely that premiums will go down a little bit, for particularly for younger people, and will go up more substantially for older people. That's what it appears from my reading today and from many other analysts' reading. Deductibles are very likely to go up for most people under this plan the way it's written. And in terms of the number of people covered, that remains unclear. There is a possibility that coverage losses won't be as great as they are projected to be under the House version of the bill. But there is also, under this bill, no mandate for coverage, and there is no penalty for non-continuous coverage, and that was a provision within the House bill. So the question is, what is there to compel younger, healthier people to buy coverage under this bill, particularly given that the provisions that suggest that the plans will cover much less? There's something called actuarial value in the bill that talks about covering only 58% of the average person's expenses, and that's different than the Affordable Care Act, where the average plan was supposed to cover 60 to 70% of an average person's expenses. So it's really going to depend on what there is in the bill that's going to get people to participate. And on this early reading, it seems that we will see some overall coverage losses, perhaps younger, healthier people deciding to pick up some minimal coverage, but it's not quite clear yet.
We'll leave it there for now. An ongoing story. Donna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
That was Donna Friedsam, researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She joined us today to talk about the Senate's health care plan, a draft of that plan released by Senate Republicans earlier today. You can still weigh in with your thoughts on this issue. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or head over to the Central Time Facebook page and share your thoughts while you're there.
High levels of the air pollutant ozone still plague a few Wisconsin counties along the Lake Michigan shoreline. This month, a team of scientists has been taking to the sky and water in that region to better map the source of some of the chemicals that create ozone. The gas can be harmful to breathe and is a main ingredient of urban smog. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Health alerts called ozone advisories aren't as common as they used to be. You can partly thank cars for that. Most vehicles these days put out less of the emissions that form harmful ozone on sunny days. Same goes for many industrial smokestacks. But on June 2nd and the 11th, the Wisconsin DNR announced that ozone levels in five counties along Lake Michigan had entered an orange category. That meant the air those days was unhealthy for sensitive groups like the elderly, children, and people with respiratory ailments. It's no surprise to scientist Brad Pierce of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, that ozone remains a concern along the western shore of the lake. He says this time of year, wind often brings cooler air off the water to collide with warmer air over the land.
What that does is it leads to transport of pollutants from along the shore, Chicago, Milwaukee, and various point sources along the way, and they tend to narrow themselves and converge right along the lakeshore.
Pierce, who's based at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, says ground monitors show ozone readings right along the lake are higher than just a few miles inland. At least one major study in the 1990s looked into the issue, but Pierce, lead researcher on this year's effort, says another look is justified because monitoring technology has improved. He also says various businesses that find it tougher to expand when there's a local ozone problem have asked for more measurements. Some of the readings are being taken miles in the air. A plane owned by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, prepares for takeoff from Truax Field in Madison. It's heading for high above Lake Michigan near Sheboygan. NASA scientist Jay Alsati says a sophisticated instrument on board called GeoTasso will try to create a two-dimensional map of plumes of ozone and another chemical, nitrogen dioxide.
We're trying to find what is the most efficient bang for the buck, really. What types of emissions are contributing to poor air quality in particular areas, and under what conditions.
The ozone study also makes use of a research boat. This NOAA vessel has been taking EPA scientists up and down the lake. At the Sheboygan Harbor, EPA researcher David Williams says holes in the mast take in air that goes to computers below deck for analyzing. Williams says there's a typical pattern.
So in the morning you'll see higher numbers of the nitrogen compounds, and then the ozone starts forming and converts that nitrogen compounds into ozone. So we get higher ozone measurements in the afternoon.
Also at Sheboygan, UW-Madison space science and engineering researcher Tim Wagner has spent a lot of the last month in a trailer filled with a bank of computer screens and instruments that measure wind, temperature, and air particles. Wagner says he's looking at how the conditions might affect the pollutants.
We can use that to create better models, to better forecast when the bad air days are going to be. We can help narrow down where we need to start doing better pollution control.
The ozone research project comes as President Donald Trump's EPA has given states another year to comply with tougher ozone limits approved by President Barack Obama. The scientists emphasize any decision about whether their findings will lead to changes in ozone laws is up to politicians and agency administrators. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Amazon is buying Whole Foods, adding to its huge role in the American and global economies. Our guest says the internet giant is creating a new kind of monopoly.
We'll find out how a change in healthcare laws could affect hospitals in Wisconsin, especially when it comes to charitable support for low-income patients.
And on Food Friday, Lori Skelton is back to share the secrets of great summer salads using fresh seasonal produce.
That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.